Well, Mary, anyway, can you tell us a bit about your life, your when you were born, your parents, your brothers and sisters?
Well, I was born near Lucan at the 12th block. My father and mother were, of course, my father was a younger son, so pretty impecunious, and he was a vet. And they were renting a bungalow, a farm there by the 12th block with an option to purchase. And just before I was born, there was a boy drowned in the lock, a friend's son. And the result was my grandmother kicked up until my father bought a different property. So I was only 6 weeks old when we moved to Somerton. I had an elder brother, Edmund, who was 2 years older than me. And afterwards, born at Somerton, was John, who was 2 years younger. And that's the lot. And we lived in Somerton until I was five. And then moved to Castle Warden.
Right. And is your mother or father, one of them was from Wales, wasn't it?
My mother was from Wales. Well, my father was one of the, what do you call it, Redmondites who believed what the British Prime Minister said, Asquith, that Ireland would get their freedom if the Irish people went and fought in the First World War. And he with a lot of other men. Conor Cruise O'Brien's uncle, Tom Kettle, was the leader of the whole group. He was a great newspaper writer and university man, and they all followed him. But anyway, my father was gassed. He was out, they were bringing in horses to be destroyed or got better again to use them again. Of course, there were no tractors in the First World War. Cannons, everything were filled with horses. There must have been an awful lot of them out. But anyway, he rode into a gas pocket. And so he was from one hospital to another. Then he'd be better and be back at another station, perhaps in France, or at what they called a remount station in England, where they had the horses that they were getting better to go out again. And that's where he met my mother, because she was an army nurse. And in Liverpool, rather. She trained in Birkenhead, but she was Welsh. And so he brought her back to Ireland with him when he came home. And then, of course, he had to get back into practice again, because his private practice, of course, had been left. Not that the vets of that time had a very busy time. The vets of today don't know what those men did, that and those. They were the ones made the job for them. I mean, he was the only one. There was one over beyond Rathfarnham and another in Bray. There were two in Dublin, would you believe, two.
Two vets.
Yeah, O'Leary in Parnell Street and Lambert in Camden Street, Richmond Street, I should say. There was an old vet in Nace, Harrison, and then there was one in Kilcock. And that's the whole lot of them. They all knew each other and worked together.
Right, yeah.
But he did everything on a BSA bike. And then when he got a little bit better off, got a second-hand car, one they called them two-seaters in those days. They had two seats, and then the hood came down, and there was a little back place outside, like a luggage part, that they could put a seat in and put two people out in the open. You may have seen them at the rallies and that. But that was how they got.
Had you any experience of, or did you tell you about any?
Well, of course, in his early, soon after he qualified, he was in doing private practice for in this area, and one of his clients was Edward Kennedy, who lived at Baron Rath over on the canal between Kiel and Strathen. And he was breeding a horse from an Arab stallion and an Irish mare, or the other way around. I'm not quite sure there. But anyway, it was an unusual way. Apparently they had done it before, the other way around, successful. Nobody had succeeded in breeding in the way he tried. And they said they weren't healthy foals. But anyhow, he succeeded. And my father was the vet present when a horse later known as the Tetrarch was foaled, which won every race as a two-year-old, and then got most awful arthritis and wasn't fit to do with the Derby or anything, because they say he was one of the fastest horses ever. At the same time, they bred from him again, and all the famous horses that we have had nowadays, Nijinsky, Tullier, all those, they all have a trace of Tetrarch blood in them.
Oh, right.
You know, the daddy of them all, sure. But anyway, my father's funnier experiences, of course, were driving car up around the mountains here, over the fields, everything. He had, after the two-seater went, he had four-seater Ford, a Model T, with a soft hood that let down, and of course no sides in it, anything at all. An awful car to be in bad weather, but he maintained he could go anywhere with it, and that if anything went wrong with it, there was always somebody could help you to fix an old Ford. But I should have told you one story about him, which I think it should be told, is he was on the at the stage when he was on the motorbike and the black and tans were around. He was over beyond British. Now at that time, it was before I was born, they were living at the 12th block. And he got on the bike, and he was only coming away from the farm when he had heard a tan lorry coming down, one of these big tan tenders. And he knew that if he budged or did anything at all, that he would be shot in the back. And so he kept coming, and he came down on the motorbike the whole way down from British, down the Blessington Road, down Man's Lane, and down through Saggart, and with the searchlight pinned on his back the whole way down. And he came down around and round by Baldonnel, and right down to his own front gate, and turned in there, and they drove on down into Luke and then left him. But he came into my mother, and I mean, he used to have very bad times sometimes because of the gas. I mean, his lungs were rotting away, you know, and he wasn't fit to move hardly. He said it was the worst experience he ever. He thought he would never get home at all that night.
Shock and fear.
Yeah. Some of the things that happened round about were, you know, we weren't the worst area, I don't suppose, but there were some bad experiences with people around as well.
Mary, can you tell us a bit about your school days and any particular games you might have played, or your favourite games?
Well, we started with a teacher coming to teach us after her school hours. And when we were in Lucan, she came from half past two, half past four, and Miss McGovern, and I was only, what, three and a half, and I Edmund was five and a half, and the third member of the group was Patricia Fitzmaurice, whose father was an airman in Balgama. She was brought down every day to join us. And we were, if I got tired, I got down off the chair and went and lay on the floor or something for a while, because it was very tiring to be sitting at the dining table, you know, for a small one like me. But then when we came to Castle Warden, teacher up there, Miss Brennan, used to come from 5 to 7. And imagine, do you know what she got a week for teaching us? 5 shillings. 3 fives. 5 for each of us and 5 for Pat. 15 shillings. Which was nearly as much as a junior teacher like her got for her pay in those days.
Right.
You know? And then, just before my father died, only 12 months before he died, they started us to school, to NACE. They wouldn't send us to the local two-teacher schools because the toilets and everything were disgusting, to say the least of it. And so we were sent from Blackchurch to NACE on the bus to school. And of course, the convent in NACE for me and its Christian brothers for Edmund. And I found I was far in advance of other children there. I mean, I was put into first class straight away, whereas for first communion and all, I should have been in high infants. You know. But went on in NACE then. But I didn't have a lot of games to play, because, you see, we left, apart from lunchtime and school time with the other children, I didn't see a girl again until I came back to school the next day. Because round about us, there were very few children in the houses round about us.
Right.
And what there were boys. So I didn't have much in the way of games. It was reading more than anything else with me. And then, of course, by the time I was 10, I was hooked on stamps.
Oh.
And I've had it ever since.
So how did you kind of travel up? Was it to NACE?
Well, we went on the bus. IOC was the Irish Omnibus Company was the main bus. But there were pilot buses in those days, other buses picking up passengers. And the Magnet was in competition with the IOC. And
Magnet, was it?
The Magnet, yeah. Yeah. And it was blue, and the IOC was red. And the conductor and driver on the Magnet were local men here from Rathcoole. Willie Kyo was the driver, and Pat, who died a few months ago, was the conductor. And there was great competition, picking up even children who were only paying tuppence fare, like us. I know that there were two boys who always travelled on the, IOC. And they thought that the IOC wasn't coming. And they put up their hand for the Magnet. And then they saw the IOC coming behind it around the bend below Black Church at Colmanstown. And they stood back. And the conductor got out and took the two of them by the back of the neck and lifted them into the bus. They wouldn't do that nowadays. But then it became the GSR took over. All the private companies were done away with altogether, and they had a monopoly after that.
So what time did you finish school at, and what time did you get back?
Well, I finished at 3, and then the bus was at 20 to 4 to get home. The brothers didn't come out until 3:30.
Right.
And the only time that we got had difficulty was on fair days or race days, because the bus came through from Kildare. Then sometimes we were left behind, and it was 6 o'clock before we'd get a bus then. But we never were left anywhere. in a couple of minutes, one of the local girls would come and say, "Mammy says you're to come home for your dinner," and I'd be gone, and Edmund would go off with Joseph O'Connor, who lived outside the town, and he wouldn't come back. They'd bring up to my aunt and say he's not coming home at all, he's staying the night. Mm. And then John would be gone to another house, Graham's, and we were, whatever about the other children that were traveling on the bus, the three of us were always very well-minded, the native people were very good to us.
Oh. So, kind of around the house, what did you do?
Your mother? Yes, well, in the summertime especially, we worked out helping with hay and turning hay and doing things like that. Of course, the one job we all hated, the two of us, was cutting thistles. And you had to go out with the slash hook, cutting all the thistles down. The county council was very fussy in those days. They had, I don't know whether it was the guards or whether they had private inspectors, but if you had what they called obnoxious weeds or didn't trim your hedges, you were brought to court.
Right.
And those fines for those offences are still on the books, but they have never been updated. The result is that they're not worth collecting nowadays. A half crown, what's that? Very little anyway. Ten pence, I suppose. That would be a fine, or 5 shillings, which is what, 25 pence, would be a big fine, you know, for doing it. But in those days, there were people, everything was much more tidy around this area, the fences, everything were well kept. And the farm men laid the hedges. They part cut them. They trimmed off all the briars and everything, and then the young trees and young branches were laid, as they called it. They didn't completely cut them off. They cut halfway through so that the life was still in it, and bent the branch over.
All right.
So that then a growth coming up from the rest of the hedge that had been cut back came through that. And they didn't need, they had great fences in that way without ever needing barbed wire or anything, except in a place where for some reason it was weaker. You know, when my father died when I was 7, that left us very, very badly off. My mother had no pension of any kind. My elder brother went to live with my uncles and aunts. We were just us two smaller children left at home with her. And it was, the farm was about 40 acres, and it was all mixed crops, some sheep, about 30 odd sheep, and about 14 cows. Because the real bread and butter was the dairying and sending the milk to Dublin. That was something that you had coming in. It was very small.
Yeah.
Because they got very, very little for the milk.
Right.
But it was a regular amount.
And most of the farms in the area would have done.
Oh yes, every house along the road, it did. And they, the milk lorry came round and collected the churns. Your morning milk and your evening milk were two separate churns, because one would be still warm and one would be cold from the night before, so they didn't mix them.
Yeah, right.
And there were no inventions like coolers, things in those days. The milk was tested then when it went to the dairies, and you would get a notice. Some of the people were fairly careless, but we had most wonderful workmen. My mother would never have managed without him. He's a story in himself, because he had been Jimmy Mahady. He had been in school in the monastery in Clondalkin, and his father was working on a farm called Smith's of Neilstown. It was an Englishman, Mr. Smith, and he was a splendid farmer. And they lived in the lodge, which is still there. It's a coal store or something now, if you're going down that direction. But we called him Maddy always. His name was Jim Mahady, but we always called him Maddy just. And when Maddy was about, his father hurt himself and got arthritis that afterwards and wasn't able to work. And they would have been thrown out of the lodge if Maddy hadn't been taken out of school and put to work. Well, he'd always, from the time he was able to do anything, he'd always been given little jobs around the place. And he took to it, and he learned everything he could. So when he grew up, he worked with Mr. Smith, ploughing and so on, and then he left when he got married to look for a better job and went to work in Clondalkin paper mills. And they closed down, they had a long strike and so on. And just after my father came to live at the 12th Lock, he met him again. He gave him a lift by chance. He met him. And he decided that he would be a good man for him. So he was a very, very intelligent man. And my father used to have difficulty sometimes if he had to do an operation on a horse or something. Getting the people belonging to who owned the horse or there to do what he told them, the way they held him then.
Right.
So of course he always took Maddy with him.
Yeah,
and then when he died, Maddy stayed with us, and he used to at first cycle up from Lucan every day to Castlewarren, 8 miles, took going, and home at night. Then after a while, he used to stay at night. And he was a fabulously clean man with the cows. And I do want to see him scrubbing up before he went to milk. And then he kept the cow shed. It was where we went out to play on wet days because it was always completely clean in the daytime. But then in the way of tillage, even though we didn't have particularly good horses, we had one good one, the other wasn't quite as good. He was marvelous with the tillage, and I'm sorry, but sometimes I get stuck in things. He could improvise. For instance, when the mowing machine, in the middle of the summer, the bar which went between the two horses broke, and he couldn't get one that fitted it in time to start, and the weather was good and had to be seized.
Yeah, right.
And he went up and down the road looking at the young ash trees, and he picked out one which was absolutely dead straight, cut it down, brought it home, planed down, made the pole, and took off all the iron plates and things and refitted them, and worked till late at night, and was ready to go the next morning again with his machine working again. You know, he worked it. My mother hadn't a clue about what work should be done on the farm,
yeah,
what took precedence and what. He knew, and he did it his way.
He took a pride in it.
But he also, on a wet day, Maddy would take out a chair in the kitchen to the garage, and all the local boys would arrive to have their hair cut. It was great, this. He kept our old broken down bicycles in tremendous order. And he, as well as that, he paid, first of all, he had a melodeon, and then he got an accordion. Those were the days when the Poor of Focal scheme was being dug from Poor of Focal to Dublin with the water scheme.
Right, yeah.
And it was all done by Labour because there were no, what do you call it, JCBs or anything then. And there was an army of men brought from the south and the west and everywhere. And one of our local neighbours, she was from the north and she was very enterprising. So she turned her hay barn into a dance hall and they paid sixpence each. And of course, all the local girls flocked there to meet all the men. And there's plenty of those men settled down and married around here that came up from Cork and Kerry and Galway and so on.
Where would they have stayed? Was it just in houses in the area?
Stayed in all around the houses. Right. Some of them slept in sheds and everything so as to have the money to send home.
Yeah.
But they paid their sixpence. Well, the whole band was Jimmy Mahadi and his accordion, Jim Marr. His name was O'Mara, but he was always known as Jim Marr, and his fiddle, and Paddy Smith, and what they his banjo, and what they called the jazz effects, EFEX, the way we used to think it was, effects. But that was the band.
What kind of music did they play?
Well, Cayley in old time.
Right.
Maddy was a great band for Cayley and stuff, but, and of course he played in all the local house parties, weddings and wakes and so on. He was in tremendous demand at night for these things.
Right. He seems to be very talented.
He was brilliant man altogether. There was nothing that man couldn't do. I mean, if he had been born in this age and able to go on at school, I think he'd have been a great businessman. Great person.
So what kind of entertainment besides Cayley was there? Like, you know, you said yourself that you used to do a lot of reading.
Yeah, it did. Well, my aunt was an honorary librarian in Rathcoole, and she allowed us to take as many books as we wanted. So on Thursday nights, we went down and would come home with the school bags full of books and bags on the handlebars and the bikes. Well, she had a card for all the deceased members of the family as well as the living ones. She had a pack of cards with a rubber band around which we used to put the library ticket into for each one. So we took them. And then of course my mother would say, now bedtime, down with the books. And I for one would have always had a book hidden away under my mattress.
Oh, right.
And then we had little lamps in the bedroom because, well, I had one because I had been badly frightened and used to have nightmares. But anyway, of course, I turned up the little light and it would be smoking the ceiling, and I was reading with it until my mother smell the smoke and come along and remove it. We had different things happened up there. You were talking about weather this morning. Mm. We had one colossal snowstorm, and my mother, again a stranger to such conditions, wasn't prepared for it at all. She couldn't make homemade bread, for instance, like the other women that lived round about. Now, when I say round about, there was no nearer house than about a quarter of a mile away, you know, and then further than that. But therefore, she didn't buy flour in big quantities or anything. And every Friday morning, I took in a shopping list to a shop, bar and groceries that were then in Nace, McCormick's. And their horse and cart delivery would be out by the afternoon with everything, and then she would pay for it when she got it. That was always on Friday. Well, a huge snowstorm started on Thursday. And when we were coming from school, everywhere was different. Now, my uncle happened to be at his Newbridge office on the, I was always there on Thursday. And he gave us a lift from Nace, but he saw the condition and he refused to come off the main road to drive us up to the house in case he got bogged. And there we were left out, the two of us, at the corner with a mile to walk in the snow. But we got home anyway, and that was the last bit. It was coming on for dark when we got home. It was, I think it was the 27th of February. But anyway, that was the last bit of light we saw in the house for a week, because the snow came down that night. The whole, it was a bungalow, and every window was snowed right up. You couldn't, the front door, you couldn't go near it at all. It was completely banked. The back door was more in a shelter because it was the dairy jutted out beside it, a shelter. So we were able to get out through there. Well, of course, the first thing was a friend staying with us. He worked in the ESB, and he and Maddie and my mother, the first interest was the animals. So they dug their way to the cow shed, and they had plenty of turnips and hay available for the, so the cows were all right and were left in. And then the sheep were a big worry, because Maddie said sheep always went for a bank and for a ditch, and that when the thaw would come they would be drowned in the ditch. So he and this other man Joe went out, and they succeeded in finding them, in most of them, through bubbles of air coming up through the snow. And we only lost four altogether.
So it must have been fairly deep, was it?
Oh, it was very deep. Yeah. The horses were up under the trees. There was a wood at the top of the fields.
Right.
And two horses were up there, and the pony, and they brought them down. And they put them in. So they were happy that way. But the food was another thing, because my mother couldn't make bread. So we had potato cakes and potatoes in various forms. And there was no tea, because the tea came on Friday. Well, the adults they were in a state for tea. And right through the weekend, all we had was lashings and lashings of milk, because the milk couldn't go to the dairy. Dublin had no milk at that time. Everywhere around the town was the same.
Yeah.
But anyway, by the Monday, they had started immediately. Now, as I said, it was Friday. The whole fall was on Thursday night, Friday morning, and then it was getting rid of it after that. Of course, again, no JCBs. So the men at the other end of the road, nearer to Newcastle, they started to dig towards us to get the milk out to the main road. And as each they came to the next man's house, they joined in.
Right.
And by the time they got over to us, there was quite a team of them digging. And somewhere I have a little very, very poor photograph of my mother standing in the cart while the others were digging all round about, you know. And the snow banked as high as this room on each side of just a track for the horse to get through.
What year was that, or what period?
That would be in 1933.
Right.
And they got out to the Nace Road eventually. And of course, the Nace Road had been cleared to a degree. I mean, we were so cut off, we didn't know what was happening in the outer world at all. And so it just happened that my mother was very friendly with our local poultry instructress, Mary Collins. She was a niece of Michael Collins. And she was worried about us. And wasn't worried about anybody else but us. So anyway, when she came out in her little baby Austin along the main road, and when she got to Black Church, she thought, well, she'd done so fairly well up to that. So she turned off to come up the Castle Warden Road and immediately got stuck. So she, the track for the they'd made for the horse, she brought all the groceries and things that she had thought of, and she brought them up to the house, dug her way with her high boots through the snow, and got up. And she brought, I can remember, she brought rashers, Hafner sausages, and tea, and she brought tomatoes. I can't remember anything else, but just those, the Hafner sausages and the tomatoes. And of course, the men had to go down and dig her out and turn the car around and get her back on the road afterwards. But they did that. And when they got home, who came across the fields? McCormack's from Mace knew that everybody was going to be stuck for food. And they got their van through from Kill to what they called the Blue Door, which was on the road to Stratham at the back of Bishop's Court. And from there, they came across the fields with sacks. It was Tommy McCormack, the grocer himself, his brother Billy, his two van drivers, and a nephew of theirs, Eddie Marham, all with big sacks on their backs, with bread, rashers, tea, anything, the basic things like that, pieces of bacon, and so on. And they left something into every house they came to, no matter even if they weren't customers of theirs.
Right.
They left something with everybody. And my mother, when she saw them, the tea, oh dear, was she thrilled to see it. It more than anything else. And up to that, she'd always bought her tea in Dublin when she went in to do other shopping. And she bought Bewley's tea. And she never again, she said, well, she had to be loyal to Tommy McCormack after that fire tea from then, because it didn't matter to Bewley's or anyone. There was a very sad thing happened during that snow. On the other side, on this side, over from Saggart, there was a man who was working on the scheme, and he lived up, it would be at the back of the hill up here, very, very much further up. And he came into Murphy's, which was a bar and grocery in Saggart, and he got a sack of groceries in the snow on the Thursday evening. And they begged him not to go out in the snow. And he insisted on going. He said that the wife and children would have nothing if he didn't get food to them, five children. And he started off plodding his way through the snow. And he didn't get home. When the snow thawed, they found him outside his own gate, his bag of groceries. He got that
as far as his gate.
Right to his own gate. But at Black
How
Church...
How long did the snow actually last?
Well, it took nearly a fortnight before we got back to school.
Right.
But there was great excitement at Black Church, because there was a circus working its way down the country somewhere, and they got stuck at Black Church. And I think it was only one truck or something, that something went wrong with the truck, and they got stopped there, because I can't remember any other animals except the two elephants. And when we started back to school, the elephants were still there. And every morning, they used to have them in the sheds in my Black Church, which have all disappeared now, of course. It's all just gone under the Nace Road. The car park is there as well. But they couldn't get out the door of the shed, you see, because of their height. And the keepers, who were Indians, used to put them down on their knees and make them come out on their knees, and then they would take them across the road and down for a drink, and they would roll in the snow and in the great spectacle for us kids, you know. And
imagine.
Then one day we came from school and they were gone.
You missed them.
Yeah. Oh no. Then, of course, school wise, we're going on, and we know a secondary school in Nace for girls. The brothers was there for the boys. It was
right.
No school for the girls. So I did the Dublin County Scholarship and got it. And I wouldn't have got it only for Mother Brendan in Nace, who took me every day after school, in between classes, during religious instruction class, everything. She started me back. She said my Irish was hopeless. And she started me back at his four day shop and made me work right through from the beginning to the end. And in 3 months, she got me through the scholarship. And I got, and of course then there was no school to go to except go away to board. So it had to be, well, you could go into Dublin for day school, but then you had to get a bus at Blackchurch at 8:20 in the morning, and you wouldn't get home until nearly 7 o'clock in the evening, and then try and do homework and be out in the weather. So it was bad that way. So I was sent up to Kilcullen for 4 years. It should have been 5 years. After 4 years, I did my leaving in fifth year, and I got into the civil service the same time. And that was that for years and years and years.
Right. So what part of the civil service did you work in?
Accountant Generals and Revenue.
Right.
We were in Dublin Castle. And the building we were in, Clock Tower, is now being revitalised. For years it's been empty and just a home for the pigeons, but now it's at the present moment there a lot of EC money, I suppose, being spent on it.
Wow.
When I was there when the war broke out, I started work just on the 18th of July 1939. A raw child out of school. I didn't know, straight from boarding school into that. And of course everybody was Miss This and Mr. That, and that you didn't, there weren't any Christian names used except the ones immediately around you and that. And you stood when you were spoken to and so on. It was a real extension of school.
Yeah, but it's quite routine. And
oh yes, it was very good training. Actually, the people who were in charge of that office were good in themselves. And the result was that as I grew older, the secretaries of every department in Dublin were men that had worked with me in that building. Everywhere you went, they had, because the training was so good. And people, I know it was, people say now, oh, that sort of work is boring. Well, we only looked on the work as our bread and butter. Everybody had other interests outside. Some were going to night classes for promotion. Others were going to the university. And others were in drama. We had very strong drama connections in the castle. Gabriel Fallon, who was an Abbey actor. Larry Ellion, who was in The Gate and in The Olympia, and Breedney Lynchick, another Abbey actress, and Maureen O'Sullivan, now not the film star Maureen O'Sullivan, but the Maureen O'Sullivan of the Abbey. I shared a room with her in Diggs and heard her lines for the Abbey. But I mean, as civil servant, she was only getting about £2 a week or something, and then she got a few bob extra being in the Abbey, and it wasn't much they got there either.
So that was just part-time, was it?
Yeah. But everybody out of it, nobody minded the fact that the work was very routine.
Yeah.
Because their interests weren't centred on their work. I don't understand young people nowadays saying it's boring, because there's so much they can do after work. That what does it matter, so long as the work gets done and you can get out of it?
Yeah. And what was the wages like? Or the hours?
When I started first, it was 9:30 to 5:00. And the wage I got at that time was 33 3/4. When my birthday came round 9 months later, I got 35 2/3. That was a rise now. Think of that.
Yeah.
It was 1 1/11 was the annual weekly rise, you know. it just went like that, very, very slowly. And with the war on, Fianna Fáil were in office, and they froze our wages as well. And that made them very unpopular with the civil service, I can tell you, because up to that, there was what they called a cost of living bonus, which was part of the 33 3/4. We'd have had even less without it. But they froze that, and we got our age rise, but we didn't get the bonus, cost of living bonus at all.
Mm.
And people were, it was bad, you know, very bad. As I said, I paid 7 6/8 a week for my lunches, which was 1 6/8 a day for a 4-course lunch. And the bus fare was 7 6/8 as well, the weekly ticket. If I hadn't the money, if I wanted to get something, if I needed new clothes or something, I got on the bicycle and I did the 13 miles on the bicycle.
Back out to Castle Warren. Right.
Did
you live in town, or did you just...
No, I was only in town for a few months after having my appendix out. That was the time I was with Maureen O'Sullivan. But we, you know, we stayed good friends right up to the time she died. But it was a very hard cycle out. It was all flying in because you were downhill the whole way.
Yeah.
But right from Dublin Castle out, on the way out, it was a very hard pull, right up the keys.
Uphill all the way.
Mm. Very tough going. I don't know what else, other interests.
How long did you work with the civil service?
Oh, I was in for over 20 years. I was a late marriage, and then I was only out for 9 years, and it wasn't good at all. I had then I was in it then until I retired again.
Right.
But in the meantime, things had changed a lot.
Were you in different departments, or just in the same place?
You can't go back into the same place. It was part of the regulations that you went back into the same. So I had been working in what they call travelling subsistence before I left, and I was put back into that again. And then we... Change conditions. We had an executive in charge of the section who disliked the fact that all the people in charge, as I said, were people who I had worked with from when I was young, and they knew me better than they knew him, and would ask me a question rather than ask him one.
Uh-huh.
And because he had come on promotion from the post office, and the result was, as I said, he took a violent dislike to me, and it made things a little bit uncomfortable. So one of my friends said, you'll just have to do the promotion exam. I never wanted to be promoted because I never wanted to be in charge of other people's work. I did individual things all the time. I was years on a repayment to the farmers for petrol they used in tractors. But I direct responsibility right through to the chief, but I just did not want to have any be responsible for anybody else. But at this stage anyway, this friend said to me, you will just have to do it because you've been left behind and you've got to get out of this groove. It's the only way out of an awkward situation. So I started in the September. My niece got me an arithmetic, an old-fashioned arithmetic with all the school, secondary school one with all the answers in the back. Because I was minding my mother, who was very aged by this stage, and I couldn't leave her to go to classes or anything. And anything that I could get in the way of books and that I got and studied at home. That was September. The exam was November. And I got it, and by the middle of February, I was in circuit court. And I spent the rest of my days in the circuit court.
All right. And what was the your position there?
Well, the executive, what we had called junior executive, now called executive justice. And when I went first, I was on what they call malicious injuries. You know, when they broke school windows and smashed cars, did everything like that, that type of thing. The insurance companies at that time didn't swallow the damages if they could put it over onto the county council or the corporation. And every Monday morning, we would have about 600 cases in court of what they called uncontested malicious injuries claims. And then on Tuesday we would have the contested ones, which was a much shorter list, maybe 40 or 50. But preparing all those all the week, it was, well, I think the fact that I was an old-fashioned civil servant gave me the edge there, because when I went into it, it was an utter chaos. Then I gradually got it, the files into order and so on, got them done that we were able to get through them and things didn't get lost, because at the time that I went there, there was a long list of lost things that people were asking for, this file and that file, and couldn't be found. Well, I cured that. But then I was on a different kind of cases after that. I lost for a second for the name of them, but it was where, if for instance, if you owed me a debt and I took action against you for not paying it, and then you didn't reply, for instance.
Right.
Judge Nealon, who was the in charge of the president of the circuit court at the time, he had established a rule that if people didn't reply, then they were accepting responsibility. They did owe it.
Yes.
If they didn't owe it,
yeah,
they would reply.
Yes.
And that therefore you could give what they called judgments in the office. And instead of a judge doing it in court where it was contested, we did the judgment with the statutory charges and that in the office. We there's an awful lot of those.
Mm-hmm.
Several people working on it now, but there was only one then.
Oh, right.
And it's quite a big item. There are a lot of debts of that sort, especially in cases going bankrupt and that. Yes. The malicious injuries came to an end. The law was changed. It was an old Victorian law. Many of our laws are Victorian, you know. And this one, putting councils responsible for damages, has been in, it would have been around about 1980. that was done away with in the Dáil. And now insurance companies, that's why insurance shot up the way it did on buildings. I mean, you know, if you, for instance, we with the daycare centre, if we let anybody else use the place now, they must carry an insurance. Well, I mean, long ago, that didn't have to happen at all.
Mm.
But there you are. That was the
thing. Were you ever married, and how did you meet your husband?
Well, my husband was part of the local scene here. I mean, I knew him all my life. And his father's first wife was cousin of my grandfather's, and so we were all very much part of the same circle. And I couldn't say when I ever met him first. He was just, we were just part of the same circle. His younger brother was in school with us, and so on.
And what did he work at? Or?
Oh, he's a very large farm.
Oh, that seems.
He still has a big farm. Just behind you.
Is it, right? Can you remember any interesting characters you might have met over the years? Funny ones?
Well, it's easy to say funny ones.
Or unusual characters.
I'll tell you about one man. His name was Michael Campbell. Michael Campbell came from the Dublin tenement, and he was in school in the Strand Street Christian Brothers, which is now an itinerant school, I think. The Christian Brothers are gone out of it and all. But some famous people like Sean T. O'Kelly and those, and Alfie Byrne and so on, went to school there. But anyway, Mick was a very clever boy, and he got into the service as a boy clerk. And he, by the time he was 18, he had become a clerical officer. And at that stage, he married. And he went to live in a tenement flat himself, a basement flat. And his wife and he, they, in no time at all, they had three or four children. And they got a house in Cabra. And when Cabra houses were built around about 1930-31. And he thought this was great, getting a house. And he went off to Cavendish's, which were hard purchase furniture people, and he got everything, including a piano. And of course he wasn't able to pay for it. So in no time at all, everything was taken out of the house. They were left with nothing. And everybody in the office, they all knew he was a terrific man to work, but they knew he was a hopeless character in himself. And so they got around, and they got, one had a bed, and another one had a couple of chairs, and another one had a table, and they set him up again. And then he had a breakdown himself. One of the men, Joe Fox, used to go to his house because they didn't want his service to break. In those days, if your service was broken, you were out, you see, if you hadn't. And doctors didn't give certs very easily. And even if you had a cert, it would only cover you for a very short time. You would get full pay for 6 months and half pay for 6 months, and then you were out. Or with a nerves breakdown, it took a long time.
Right.
So Joe used to go to his house every morning and collect him and walk the whole way from Cabra down with him to Dublin Castle and walk back with him in the evening and see that he was safe home. And that went on until he was fit to come in and out by himself. The number of children went up and up and up until there were, I think, 8 or 9 live children, and there had been a number that had died as well. But on one occasion, when his wife was in having, it was during the breakdown period, she was in having a baby, and he was on his own. And one of the girls from the office, Peggy Moore, she went up, to see how he was. And found Mick in the house, no fire, the children playing around the fire, no anything. So she went home to her mother from Phibsburg and told her, had a stew ready for the dinner for the Chittaby family. And she just put it into what they called three-quart can in those days, and put potatoes into another one. And she said, take those. And she got one of the boys, Tony, with his bike, with a bag of coal and some sticks and that on the bike to push that up. And Peggy to go around and give them the dinner. So when Tony had got up with the stuff before Peggy got there, and she went in, and there was the bag of coal there. And Mick, she said, why didn't you light the fire? These children are cold. The Christ child had no fire. So she lit the fire, and she went and looked after them day after day then for ages. But anyway, he got back to work. And would you believe, in this day and age when people can be bribed and everything can happen, that was the man that prepared the figures for the budgets, for the figures prepared for the budget estimates.
Oh yeah.
He prepared all those.
All right, for the government's.
And that he was doing that as a clerical officer only. Nowadays, of course, they're very important people that do things.
Yeah.
They've been regraded completely.
Oh, yes.
But that really was the thing.
Right. You seem to be a person who has kind of travelled to a lot of in different areas. What was your first contact with Talla?
That was after my marriage broke down. I went down to Talla. And I had been on the community council here for 10 years. And then I was a resident and then became the community council here. And then when I went to Talla, something happened that made me aware that there was a community council. And I went to the meeting. And it was held down by the swimming pool. They had no room, no space to hold it, and that splashing of the and shouting from the swimming pool, you couldn't hear. So I'm afraid, although I was so new to it, I got the meeting abandoned and got it reconvened. And the following week, it was held in the Priory, in one the big hall in the Priory. And for my sins, I got myself elected as Minutes Secretary. And I did that for years and then became treasurer afterwards until I left eventually and went when I sold the house in Talla and went to live up in Britis.
Right. So when was it founded, the Talla Community Council?
Oh, well, that was before, I don't know what time, but I suppose most of these were founded around about 1960s, in the 1960s. Mm.
So that's it. Talla was a very different place.
Completely different.
Have you any memories of what Talla was like?
Well, certainly when I went there, there were an awful lot more green fields than there are today.
Yeah.
And we were looking for, Jim Higgins was the chairman at the time, we were looking for a community centre. And at that stage, looking for one community centre for Talla. When you think of all the different ones there are around the place now, of course, the community council never got a building of their own. The rest of the places like Kilmanana and Springfield and so on have splendid ones. But there is no central place that would ever figure as a town hall. Mm. I noticed in the paper this week, in the Echo, Tom Mars talking that Talla should be listed as a city. Well, they're not even listed as an urban district council. There was Nace, and in the days when I was in school, it was already a very strong urban district council, and there weren't more than 3,000 people there, I suppose.
Mm.
Talla, with all its crowds, Martin Darby, who was the secretary when I was in it, was preparing the papers for applying for urban district council status and had got all the I think it was 30 or 35 signatures that were needed of people of status in the area and so on. He had everything done. And for some reason, Mervyn Taylor, who was the advisor on legal matters and all, stopped him from actually sending it any further. And it never, I could never understand that. And Martin himself could never understand it. He didn't know exactly who was behind this move to, I know Mervyn Taylor advised against going ahead with it, but I think that after that, Fianna Fáil members, who were very dominant in the community council, were united against it for some reason that the party only knew. And there it hung, and never was, nothing was ever done about it. So, bit by bit, the community council itself stopped having any significance. Every residents' association around the area decided to work to the council on its own and bypassed the community council, which has very little function now at all.
Yeah, in the last couple of years, it seems it has.
Very little, less and less.
Not very much about it.
No.
But,
pity.
Yeah. But can you remember what it was like 40 years ago?
Well,
saying that it was very much a lot of green areas.
That's among those photographs I was showing you, there should be one. Mr. Taylor took several of those from the Tower of the Priory and from the Tower of St. Melrose. And there's one splendid one that he took looking towards Dublin. And there's nothing from the village, the wall of the priory down to Terenure but green fields. You know, not even Bancroft built or anything at the time. It would really show you what was life in those days. The roads, of course, were narrower. We went up and down to Terenure, my brother's school there, and that'd be the only reason that would have brought me over onto this side.
Mm-hmm.
Very much, you know, in the early years. But Tala was such a small place. And the garage that's been, you know, with the tigers on it now, Mrs. Nugent, you know, who they have the shop there opposite where the garage is.
Oh yeah.
Vera. She used to run the pumps there. And they were only just pumps, and that was the only thing. There was one shop, which was the Marion Stores, which was where Tom Marr has his office is now. And there was nothing else. We used to come over in the early morning from when we left Castleward, and we lived in Saggart, and we would come over in the early morning to early mass, if it was sort of a novena time, like novena sacred heart or something, because of course you had to fast for communion in those days, and you couldn't sort of fast till lunchtime. No, we didn't anyway. To go across Wharton's Town, and it was just country lane, and down to the crowd. There was nothing sort of the odd house and farm here and there. It was all there was between Saggart and the Priory. Nothing else on at all. The early morning and. Everybody would be heading, half the men and girls that you'd meet on bicycles would be going to Swiftbrook to work. And then when you went further along, you would see people going into Erne to work. Right. Those were the two big employers.
What was Swiftbrook again? Where was it?
Swiftbrook was paper mills here in Saggart. Employed about 400 people, and they had, they made all the high class papers, banknotes, and Kamek, the river that runs down from Britain, were two of the only two in this part of the country at all that had paper mills on them. And the Kamek, they made the ponds of the British to safeguard the water for them. But you see, Swiftbrook was the highest up. Therefore, the water was the purest when it came there. And they did high-class paper. Further down at Clondalkin, they did coarser papers and wrappings. Further down again at Killeen, they did cardboards and so on. And then Drimna Mills, further down again, did even rougher stuff, cartons, and you know, that kind of thing. The Swiftbrook was the high-class one, ancient Irish vellum and Swiftbrook bond, and those, they were beautiful papers. It was a tragedy that they were closed down.
When did they close?
Well, see, it was a company. Well, there were a few. I don't know whether it was a public company in any sense of the word. But there were a few directors other than the Horsburgh family, but the Horsburgh family were the principals in it. And Mr. Horsburgh had no boys in the family, and there was nobody to take over after him.
Right.
And the result was that when he decided to retire, the company decided to close down, and they sold it to Clondalkin Paper Mills, who closed it down and took whatever was left of the business down to Clondalkin. Mm-hmm. Well, of course, paper making fell on bad period then, and Clondalkin closed as well.
Right.
And that was the end of them all. I think Drimna's, Killeen is now, I think, part of Mr. Smurfit's organisation, and it produces packing papers and things.
Can you remember the tramway? No.
Barely. I can remember being lifted up into it, and this big belching engine with smoke and dust and very noisy. And I think we must have been going down. I had an uncle living in Terranure. He was a rate collector. And we must have been going to his place. It would be the only one. And that's the only memory I have of it.
This is when you'll be a child.
Yes, I couldn't have been more. I mean, what age was I? I was only 8 when it closed down. But I don't remember it at that stage. I can only remember the earlier one. And one other memory I have of it was up at Bliss's. In 1928, they were building new schools in Newcastle. And we were all out collecting for it. My aunt was really doing collecting, but she took us 3 children with her. And if she thought that one of us would get a better response in any of the houses, each one of us was sent in turn, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And when we were up at Britis, the tram apparently was coming by. And she got down and she got the trap rug and put it around the bunny's head, so as to that he wouldn't be frightened by the tram, and she held him firmly while it went by because of the noise, because that was one of the big problems along there, was the number of horses and ponies that ran away because of the noise of it, you know, and people were killed not by the tram but by the fact of the horse running away. Those are my only 2 memories of it. But when all the stock was sold off, my uncle bought 3 of the cattle trucks off it. And they had huge big garden frames. But one of them was put on ground that belonged to the family over where Westbrook buildings going on now at Embankment. And there was one of them there. And then another one, 2 of them were in the yard at Hillview, at my father's home. One was for a hen house and the other was for a store. And they were there, and they weathered the storm for years and years. The one at Embankment, at Borboy is the name of the place, it was my brother and his pals used to camp out there. He was in the Scouts in the headquarters, Scouts in Stephen's Green, Dublin, and all his friends and himself used to camp there at weekends and during holiday periods and all, you know. And that was their base.
Mm.
But you know, I was told by a man who came to a lecture we had on the Blessington tram that the steel from the line was so pure and so good that during the they'd all been taken up, of course, and they were apparently stored in some yard in town. And during the Second World War, when they couldn't get steel for bullets, that it was good enough to use for that. And he was in the army by this stage and was in charge of whatever group of metalsmiths and that were doing it.
Yeah. That's interesting. Yeah. So they melted it down and
were able.
So what actually got you interested in history, and particularly local history? Was it something that you had when you were a child, because listening to stories being told by parents?
My parents, both my father and my mother, were great at telling things, and my aunt in Rathcoole was particularly good at it.
This is the Shields.
Yes.
Yeah.
My first cousin of my father's, who would be almost a generation older than him, John Shiel O'Grady from Newbridge, was one of the founders of the Kildare Archaeological Society. And we used to have a little booklet that he did on Rathcoole. Mm. I still have it.
Yeah.
That way. Well, then, in primary school, we were encouraged, and primary schools did an awful lot more than they do today, you know. They had a local history class once a week on Monday morning, and we were all encouraged to bring in bits about our own area.
Right.
And go around and talk to the neighbours and ask them what they remembered and that, you know.
Right.
It was very good that way.
Something that's kind of lost.
Yes. Yeah. Well, I think children nowadays are treated more at, I suppose I was 10 when we were doing that, 10 and 11. By the time I was 12, I was in doing primary search and then the Scal. It must have been 10, 11. I think we were a lot more advanced in that way than children are today.
Mm.
We're more literary, if you like.
Yeah, right.
We started doing history and geography in second class. We started with the story of Ireland and with simple geography. And then the following year, we were doing the same thing in Irish, and we were advancing in the history and geography. By the time we were in fifth class, we were able to do it all in Irish, you know. I don't know whether the kids today would have told them that.
Yeah.
Doing world geography in Irish in fifth class
is some good going, all right.
Yeah, I think we got good teachers in incumbent and this. But I mean, that was standard, I suppose, around the country at the time.
Do you notice an attitude now in, you know, like, do you see things better now? Is people more interested in history now than they say in the past, or particularly among the
I think that long ago, when there was no television and that, and people sat around the fire at night talking, that they talked more about these things. But that nowadays, there's so many other things to do that they don't have time.
Yeah, there's more distractions.
Yeah, far more distractions. But certainly with the History Society, we can get people to come to lectures occasionally if you have something
that catches their eye.
Yeah. When we had Donegal Dooling on, for instance, we had the place full.
Yeah.
But then when we, in the ordinary way, they just say, thank you very much, put in their pound or whatever, and they're gone. Mm-hmm. They never bother to see, can we help you in any way, or to join in it and take some part in the thing. So the result is, our History Society, and I believe it is the same with a lot of them, are only a number of old people. There are about six of us who are in any way active in it.
When was it formed and were you?
Mrs. Taylor, Harry Taylor's wife, started it in 1970. She was terribly keen on the whole subject. Well, she was founder of the Community Council as well.
Oh, was she?
Yeah.
Nice.
And so they did a lot of going around taking pictures and so on. Some of his other pictures of Bornabrina and so on are very nice too.
Nice.
But they did a lot of that from pure interest themselves, and then started the society.
So it was just really interest. It wasn't something that got them motivated, seeing what was happening around the demolition of old buildings.
I think the first thing that I remember, now I wasn't involved because I was working and looking after my mother, but the first thing that I think was they started to clean up the Bald Brook stream, and they got everybody local out helping to do that.
Oh,
was one of their early things. And they used to, at that time, they had, as well as lectures, they used to issue a newsletter.
Mm.
And that, you know, a photostated one.
Right.
With, I have one or two of them, I think, among the papers. But the man who used to do that, he got involved in something else and wasn't able to come, and nobody else did it.
Took it on. Yeah.
So on. And it went on like that. That's it. Bit by bit, there's nobody left. And they're starting a history society in Sagart now, so I think I'll leave the Tallaght one too.
Well, looking upon it, do they have successes or failures? Like, I know you were very active in trying to stop the demolition of Allenton House.
And we failed. Well, Allenton was destroyed before we came. We tried to stop the rest of the demolition of it, but it was too bad to do anything about it. The county labelled it a dangerous building, and that was it. The one that we were very disappointed about was failing to get the where the Tella Auto Parts face is now.
Right.
We fought that because the outer wall or fosse of the old Tallaght priory of the St. Maelrose period ran right through that ground. And the part of it where they have the bit of green grass there, it came into that. And that's why they weren't allowed to build on that, but they were allowed to build on the rest, which we thought was disastrous.
Mm.
No, but we did try to fight that.
Okay, well, thank you very much, Mary, for all this. And
well, I'm sure you will cut the bits and bits and bits of
it. I don't think so.
There's a lot of rubbish in it, but
we could spend hours on those. There's a lot of other questions I would like to ask you, things about raccoon and all that.
Mm.
But it's a start.
Well, it's, I mean,
almost people